You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm getting yelled at, okay? Hold on, let me play some music, then he can finish yelling at me. I don't even know what he's yelling at me for. Joining me from the great state of Texas, a native hometown, home state boy, Michael Musselman. What's going on, Tex? How's life going today?
Hey, it's good. You're a Texan.
It's great to be a Texan.
Shit, yeah, man. It is great to be a Texan. And let me tell you why.
What?
I was at the debates all last night.
Commissioner debate. And?
Yeah. You know, it's the questions, you know, like, where do you stand on this? Even though it's not a commissioner thing, like, where do you stand on sanctuary cities? And, you know, it's the guys that were running for the precinct, my precinct is not running, so these were friends of mine, you know, and I was there to support them. And, but they are such staunch constitutionalists, Americans, patriots. You know, these guys, it's just it amazes me. And I was just sitting there like, man, we're in good hands. Because these guys, they know the Constitution. They're talking about things, you know, and they went on a little, you know, because some of the questions are like, well, if you could do this or do that, and what do you think is important? We talked about the 17th Amendment, you know, it was really a good forum last night, and a lot of people were walking out there with, you know, my buddies were running, were like, wow, he was really good. And, you know, we talked about natural law, and we talked, you know, what's important to you, and the values, and where did we go wrong, and how can we get this thing back? And it was, again, we're talking county commissioners, they did do budget stuff here in the county, but the questions were really hard as far as, do you think you're running for president of the United States?
No, you know,
I think Donald Trump had easier questions at the debate. These guys did.
But Mike, I mean, doesn't it make you feel good about, you know, you go to something like that, and again, I will tell you that, you know, there's all kinds
only here in Texas, though, brother.
Yeah, it doesn't happen anywhere else. There you have it. That's why we should all move to Texas.
Not in freaking name a city in Orange in California that talks like that. Come on.
Well, in the Valley, they want to secede from the state. New California.
Yeah, you know, and you know, if you look at, and that's the thing that bugs the crap out of me, is California. If you look at it as a whole, there's a lot of Republican conservative views.
I know.
It's the cities, though. Yeah, it's that.
Yeah, it's like, all these people from Des Moines, from Minneapolis, from Eden Prairie, they all come out here to find themselves. California is a huge agricultural state with all the conservatives that go with agriculture. And then you have two big...
I see what you did there. I see what you did there, but it doesn't work because I was born in California.
I know. I thought I'd try Eden Prairie in there. But I mean, it's like people like, when they come out to visit, it's like, where do you want to go? Well, I want to go to Venice Beach and I want to go to Hollywood and Vine. You could rent a car and do that because I've never been to either place. I have no desire to go because it's just a bunch of stupid people that aren't from California that are out here trying to find themselves. So go knock yourself out. I'm not going.
One of Ron's friends, who's now a friend of mine, lives in Malibu.
Oh.
And he's trying to sell his house in Malibu and move to more rural areas, you know, like Oregon or, you know, up there. He will stay on the West Coast.
Right.
But he comes out here to Texas and just has a blast. And, I mean, he has a blast. Big time lawyer out there. He's done good for himself. I mean, his house in Malibu is probably $25 million home. You know, and we were talking when he was out here, and Ron and I were talking about last night, too, was the fact that, like, Vail, Colorado, Malibu, you know what the problem with those places are? You can't move. You know, it's become the dream, this false dream of the American way of life is, oh, get somewhere, be famous, material objects, you know, and so we were talking to him, and I said, well, what's the big downfall of living in Malibu? And he goes, Mike, you know, we don't talk in miles or anything like that when we go somewhere. He goes, I go to a restaurant that literally, you know, in a normal town, it would take you 3-4 minutes to get there. It takes me 45 minutes. Because everybody, you know, it's just this, everybody wants to descend into these areas and be somebody they're not and pick up this, you know, facade. And, you know, it's just, this, you know, God, what the hell is going on with this?
Well, that's the dream, right? And then you have the tourist traffic. I took Colleen, there's a Getty had built, there's a Getty Museum up in the mountains of Los Angeles, right. Where the 405 goes over the hill by UCLA. A beautiful place and just a world renowned museum. And we went there, and then Getty also built an Italian villa that was, covered up in Pompeii by the volcano. And, so when it was excavated, he built an exact replica of it in just on this just near side Malibu. So you don't have to drive into Malibu. But the big part of going to it was, okay, when is all the tourist traffic going to start? Because the coast highway between Santa Monica and Malibu is a joke.
101.
Oh my God, it's an absolute parking lot. And so you have to pick the right time. And they were and very cool. The military, if you had your ID, you and your family got let in for free. So Colleen went and I went there. But you're right. I mean, all those places that you know everybody wants to live, you know, you could have them, right?
You can have it, man. You know, there's 1,000 people moving to Texas every day.
Yeah, I can imagine, man.
Isn't that crazy?
You're there.
Yeah, and you know, Granbury is still in the top 10 in the nation for micro cities of its size and growing in population. And that scares me.
Yeah, you want to be careful about that.
And but what you also want to do is bring in the right people.
What do you vet?
Yeah, I think I would.
Let me see your resume.
Yeah, let me see your record, your track record.
Best and, performing you know, cities. Now I'm fact checking you right now. So
well, it's micro cities. There's categories.
I'm looking for micro cities. The metropolitan statistical area. Ranked number one, San Jose. God. San Jose, Provo, Austin, Redwood City, Dallas. Two of them in Texas. Best performing large cities.
Those are big cities.
Right. I'm looking for micro cities. This is Metropolitan Division, MSA, Tacoma. Come on. Give me the little towns. What is this? Complete results. Large cities. Small cities. Small cities. Complete results. Come on. I only have small cities, Mike. I don't have micro communities.
Yeah, I'm going to send you the link. I have to find it again.
Yeah, send me the link. The small cities. The top five are Bend, Oregon, College Station, Texas, San Rafael, California, St. George, Utah, Logan, Utah, Auburn, Alabama, Columbus, Indiana, Grants Pass, Oregon, Napa, California, and Gainesville, Georgia. There you have it. So you would be smaller.
Yeah, but those are not micro.
Those are not micro. So anyway, with apologies.
We're talking about smaller.
Yeah, you know, be careful about that growth thing because pretty soon you're not Granbury, Texas anymore.
Yeah, it's scary, man.
You know what I mean? You're Oceanside, California, or you're Temecula, or you're Fallbrook, and you're growing, and because it's too nice there. But yeah, no, I'm with you. Hey,
well, and here's the interesting conversation I had with a lady here in town. She. You know, we were talking about election stuff, and she said, "Well, what is he? Is he a Republican or Democrat?" And I said, "Well, he's a Republican, ma'am." She's like, "Oh, no, I vote the Democrat ticket." And I said, "That's fine." And then she said something, and then I said, "Oh, on another candidate." And I said, "He goes, I go. He told you he's a Democrat?" And she said, "Yeah, we had a meet and greet, and he told everybody at the meet and greet that he's a Democrat. And I said, that's interesting, because he's been trying to get the Republican executive committee to endorse him. And I, like, she was, you know, like, oh, really? And I said, oh, yeah. And I told her, I said, no, the problem with too many people is they try and, they're chameleons. They'll be who what they want in front of what they they say, you know, their group. So she did some background check, and I got a phone call from her last night, and she told me, she said, you know, you were right. I found out through some other friends of mine that, you know, he is not what he's saying he's being and everything else. I really appreciate, you know, your honesty and everything else. And, but, you know, the only problems we have here when it comes to politics like that is really the people that are running on these Democratic tickets. For instance, you know, our school board, oh my God, it's just way out of control. I mean, you know, the number one person that's paid the most money here as far as elected official is in our county. You know who he is?
Head of the school board.
Yeah, the superintendent.
Yep.
He makes over $200,000 a year, and his salary is then based on the school board, because there's no other oversight, the school board. And the school board is mostly, you know, liberal type people.
Right.
And they're just not good stewards of taxpayer money.
Educators. No, and they come with, they come at you with this bullshit. Well, we need to raise his salary to $300,000 because that's what is being paid in the other, by the other, cities of our size in the region. And the answer to that is we don't care. We can get somebody, trust us, we can get somebody that's really good at this and pay them what we feel is appropriate. We don't, you know, it's not the private sector. You want to go in the private sector? Then go in the private sector. And you're not a corporate CEO, because this is not a private business. This thing is sustained by public money. And so they pay a lot of money, and because they say, like, oh, well, you know, if you were in the private sector and you were handling a business that was worth, you know, a budget of, you know, $273 million, you would be getting paid this. Yeah, but guess what? That's because that business is at risk of going away. This is not.
Well, right.
So it just drives me nuts.
This business is based on taxpayer money. And so that was their argument when they at the school board, and that's the counter argument was when they said, you know, well, based on CEOs of companies, and I went, and my counter was that this is not a business, and he's not a CEO.
Yeah. You're not at risk. He's not at risk. We will absorb your mistakes, and so you're a more of a manager than you are a CEO with all the rules that go into it. And the other thing that drives me crazy in when you have the highest paid people in an area and they're all public employees, something's wrong.
Oh yeah.
Something's wrong. You know, and you can get,
well, not only that, but when your county sheriffs are making just the poverty level, you know, and they have to work two jobs, three jobs to make it. Your law enforcement, your first responders are just making it, you know, your firemen, your all those people. You know, yeah, you have there's a problem there.
There's a problem. And public unions are a piece of it. And let me tell you, there's parts of, and that's why I love local politics. I love local politics, and I just had to stop doing my local show in North Dakota because I couldn't do both shows. But, it's what I enjoy talking about. Local budgets, being fiscally accountable. And I will tell you, what's gonna drive California off the edge is you have to pay for all this stuff. And if one or two companies that's headquartered in Silicon Valley decides that they want to move out of the state of California will crumble like a house of cards because they don't have the other sources of revenue, to make up for it. And so,
you need fiscal responsibility. That's your number one goal.
Right. And that around the nation is a joke, and it's just, I've talked about it. You want to do some interesting reading? Just do a Google search on unfunded public pensions and look at what people that are retiring in some states think that they're going to get, and look at where those things are funded at. and you have pensions that are funded at 30%, that means 70% is unfunded, that they're somehow or other robbing Peter to pay Paul. California's public contribution from the state legislator has doubled since, I should be saying like 1990, right? Since 1990, it's doubled. Right. Since 2009, it's doubled. Can't sustain that. And it goes to Mike's point about being fiscally responsible. How do you run the nation? How do you run your state? How do you run your school district, your city, if you don't balance your budget and run it in the black? Stupid. I don't know. But it's I love local politics, man. I love local politics. I've got an email for you. Hey, Mac, has Gunner ever been to the SHOT Show? I would imagine he has. Huh. Mike?
Yeah, I used to go all the time.
What? Describe the SHOT Show. I've never been. I can only imagine.
Oh, it's pure craziness, man. I mean, it is Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, if you're into sweet. It's, you know, the everlasting gobstoppers everywhere. You know, it caters to every corner, every, you know, spectrum of survivalist gear, equipment, guns, ammunition guys. You know, you name it, man. Everybody comes out from your big companies, from Remington, Winchester, you know, all the way down to mom and pop shops that run the stuff and, you know, the backwoods of Montana or Idaho or, you know, everybody's there.
All right, let me read you a couple sentences from a story. Glock's big star at the SHOT Show is a pistol that the Army didn't buy. This article written by Matthew Cox appeared in military.com. Glock Inc. showed off its new G19X at the SHOT Show 2018 range day. The new model, which featured a compact slide and full-size frame, emerges out of the company's attempt to meet the U.S. Army's modular handgun system competition requirements, said Shane Coley, Team Glock captain. Glock lost to Sig Sauer, which also beat out FN America and Beretta USA, the maker of the current M9, blah, 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 blah. But the setback hasn't stopped the Smyrna, Georgia-based subsidiary of the Austrian firearm giant from taking advantage of its efforts to produce what appears to be a sweet marriage of full-size and concealed handguns designs. Whoa! Glock 19 is extremely popular with U.S. Special Operations Forces because of its reliability and compact size. The 19X adds more grip surface for a better grip for people who have bigger hands and also gives you more rounds with the extended magazine.
Right.
There you have it. And you heard it first? Mike Musselman.
I own one.
That's right. Somebody put it in front of his nose. He smelled it and said, honey, got to buy another pistol. Got to buy another pistol. But it is the star of the SHOT Show now.
So they'll do really well. They're going to do really well in the civilian market because it is such a reliable gun. I mean, it is such a good shooting gun. And, I mean, it comes with all the bells and whistles. You know, it is a complete turnaround from the days of yesterday. So they'll do real well.
Here's another thing you can comment on. Oh, Montana Man says Tex. ? Yeah.
I know. He just wants to stir the pot.
I'm committed to Mike being a Texan, okay? I'm done with him being a Minnesotan or a Californian.
You know what? Go breed a mule or something.
No, you know what his latest is? He sent me a picture of this. Is it a charger? What is it? Hold on. He sent me this picture last night.
He comes down to Texas to poach cattle. He buys Texas cattle.
He sent me a picture of a Mustang, like a 1965 Mustang Fastback. And and he said, "Hey, I'm looking into this. If I get it up in if I can find it, if it turns out kind of to be within the parameters and you're going up to Sacramento, would you swing through San Jose and test drive it?" I said, "Yeah, I'll do it." Napa Man, he goes up there on occasion. He goes, "Man, I'm not having a guy who wears Uggs and has tiny tires on a big truck.
Little mini tires, yeah.
Mini tires on a big truck. Test my. I said, okay, I'll do it. So yeah, that's his latest, and it's about. I want to say he told me the price was like $38,000. The thing's beautiful. Beautiful. So yeah, he's preoccupied with that. And then he sells me this. It's an investment. I'm like, it's an investment. Nice. There's other things you can invest in right now that might gain more. No. So he was like,
he was
selling me last night. All right, Marine Corps wants a piece of the Army's new lethal sniper rifle. Despite budget turmoil, the Army is moving ahead with a compact semi-automatic sniper system. All sniper performance requirements and capabilities are still valid. Marine Corps Systems Command did not respond to the request for comment, and it said the Marine Corps is on board with this Army purchase. The program was established in 2015 to field a replacement for the M110 semi-automatic sniper system. In August 2016, Heckler & Koch ended the Army's search, winning a $44.5 million contract for a lightweight version of its 7.62 G28E sniper rifle with a baffleless OSS suppressor. Okay, so talk to us about Marine Corps sniper stuff, because we take tremendous pride in our sniper stuff. Do you know anything about this weapon here?
No, I don't. And I don't know if it's the 417. The 417 is the big brother of 416, which is the IAR. The 417 won the contract in Europe. And, so I don't know if it's the 417 or something like it, but.
The H&K 417.
Oh, is that what it is?
Let's see. It says Heckler & Koch M110 A1 7.62 semi-automatic sniper rifle selected by the Army's compact semi-automatic sniper system program on display at AUSA, which is the Army big Army show.
Yeah, my guess is it say it's an H&K?
Yes.
So my guess is it's the 417. 417 is the 7.62 variant. I'm looking at it right now. HK. Yeah, that's the 417.
It's unclear if adopting the weapon will actually allay the frustrations of the Marine Corps Scout snipers. Marine snipers wielding the M40A5 are accurate at a distance of up to 1,000 meters, according to Military.com. The HK G28 selected by the Army can only provide accurate fire up to 600 meters. Yeah, interesting. Because we've all, I mean, Marine Corps sniper history, man. That's big history, yes?
Written by Marines.
Right? That's
written by Marines.
That's true.
Verified and
by other Marines. Yeah. And propagated by Marines.
Marines.
The Hitler, what's Hitler's great quote? Hitler. Churchill's great quote. I know history.
No, not Churchill, Truman, right?
No, I know history will be kind to me because I intend to write it. So.
Well, yeah, that too. But Truman's was something like, the Marine Corps propaganda rivals that of Stalin or something like that.
Truman, he's a flat-footed RD officer from Kansas. What did he know? So what's your favorite part about the SHOT Show? Do you like just walk around and drooling and grabbing stuff all day?
No, I never really enjoyed the SHOT Show except for meeting, seeing my buddies.
Right.
The problem with the SHOT Show is I get stuck at every booth and people are asking me questions.
Oh, really?
You spend so much time. You know, I never really saw it, the whole thing. I was always stuck in, different booths.
You know, going to something like that with you, I mean, it's like going with a rock star, right?
Yeah, right. Ask my wife. I took my wife one year.
I'm sure she hated it, huh?
Oh my
God. Walk like 5 feet, and then you see somebody else. And then you who's that? And then you say three words and you move 10 feet and another guy.
Well, I went with a buddy of mine. He's a deputy county sheriff of Orange County. Good friend of mine. And, all three of us went. And like the first booth we got there, I looked over at my buddy Chris and I said, hey, do you mind, you know, taking Tina around? I'll be catch up. And I never saw him the rest of the day. And then we got together and we were at dinner and, you know, they're like, oh, this is so much fun, you know? And then the next day it was like, okay, I promise I'll spend more time. And then we got stuck at Oakley and, you know, and I mean, it's just, and it was like, hey, Chris, you mind taking Tina? I'll catch up. And then, you know, didn't see him the rest of the day. My wife was like, this is a blast. I enjoy this so much.
What do you mean?
But see,
come on.
You're talking to a guy. I made a mistake. I think it was my 15th year anniversary. My 15th year anniversary. We came to Texas, and I ended up going on a 4-day hunt, and she stayed behind with the wives. I got down here on our anniversary, and we had big plans. We were going to go do stuff, and then I ended up going, you know, taking off for 3-4 days. And she stayed with the wives of all my buddies.
How did you redeem yourself from that?
I didn't. I still get that brought up.
Oh, you really?
Yeah.
I don't know. It seemed to me like you would have enough language skills that you would...
Nah, I can't back out. That's something you can't get out of, man. I screwed that one up.
You're right. I don't know. Well, I don't know. It could have led to we went to Rome for 3 days and then came home and we had a great time.
So. Well, no, because that one was a long hunt. I mean, we were gone for 3-4 days and we started in Texas and we finished in New Mexico. And so by the time I got back to, you know, my buddy's house where my wife was staying, we all got back and she's like, and I told her, I said, oh, we just got done shooting orcs in New Mexico. And she's like, what? You went to New Mexico?
Man,
not a good, no. I learned a lesson from there.
You learned, shut up, man. Shut your yap.
That was a crazy one.
That was crazy. Anything else come out of the debate last night?
No, I mean, it was really good. It was a really good debate. We got some really good commissioners running for the position, so we'll see. Then next Wednesday is the judges, so that's Ron's debate is next Wednesday. And then the week after that is the state legislator, Mike Lang, who's a good friend of mine, was really on the other side of the golf course here for me. I could see his house.
Uh-oh.
And then Mike debates his opponent. Mike's the incumbent. He's a great, you know, here's a guy that, again, Fort Worth police officer, served state of Texas, became a police officer, and then left the police department, became a constable here, and then became a constable, and then ran for state legislator. Now he's a state congressman for the state of Texas. But some of the bills that he has, you know, helped written and the things that he's done in Texas really done well for our county and our people here. And so the guy running against him is the superintendent. You know? So you're like, the question of what's going on? But I mean, the superintendent, I don't know if he's going to, he's a shady guy. So, I mean, at one of the debates, you know, they asked him, with your job as a superintendent, how do you proceed that you're going to run for office? You know, that's a lot of time that you got to take off. And he's like, oh, look at all these 3 days or, you know, time off days. And so, unbeknownst to him, the guy actually has the contract of the superintendent. And he said, where in your contract does it have these days that you're talking about? Because in your contract, it only says you're granted 7 days of vacation time a year.
Whoa.
And so, yeah, he was caught kind of, you know, oh, well.
I'll take vacation.
Yeah, but see, now he's in a position where if he is elected, because he's done two terms as superintendent, he gets to get the pension, which is going to be over $100,000. So, I mean, he makes out, you know. And so it's a sad, again, you know, it's just a sad state of affairs that we're in. These people bounce around, especially these public officials. They can do this stuff, and they run for office, and they get these garnered pensions where they run for office, they get this pension, they run for non-office, they get that pension, and before you know it, you know, they're 70 years old, and they're gathering four public elected official pensions off the taxpayer.
You know,
now, how is that fair?
Well, let me tell you this. I knew a guy. He retired from the city. He had been the director of finance, so he'd been the treasurer for the city. Worked for the city for 30 years, so got his pension there. And then he went and he ran for county commission. And so I asked, I saw somebody, I said, hey, is it true? Why is he running for county commission and not city council now that he's retired? He said, well, city council pays $500 a month, county commission pays $1,000, and there's medical coverage with your county as a county commissioner, and there's none when you're a city councilman.
Yes.
And I said, what? And they said, remember, Mac, he's the director of finance. He knows how to add and subtract, unlike you. I said, so that's why he's running for county commission? Hello. That's a big deal when you're retired. You're medical. Now it's completely covered. He just gave him, he just probably saved himself somewhere between $1,000 and $2,000 a month. I was like, holy shit, man. That's what motivates our decisions, where to run. You got to be kidding me.
Right.
All right. I want to play some audio from Quezon for you. This is like the most intense, oral history piece I've ever seen. And it's from that thing that Lance Corporal Ken Rogers did, Bravo Company 126. And this guy talks about, he's a Catholic. It's like George Costanza talking about Quezon, okay? And he says, I never fired my rifle at anybody other than on anything other than on the range. Okay, and I didn't really want to shoot anybody. I'm a Catholic, you know, so I was hoping I could get through Vietnam without having to shoot anybody. And he goes to this, like, neurotic, I won't say it's neurotic, but it's, you know, he's describing the events that are happening in front of him, and he's talking about, like, the inner monologue that's going on through his head, right? And he's going back and forth between this. So, It's awesome, but at one point he talks about his range coach, and I want you to listen to it because it's awesome. And if you missed, for those of you that are listening, if you didn't listen to yesterday's third hour in which I play this whole clip, it's they had a patrol go out on February 25th, it's 1968, and it got ambushed. It was a patrol of approximately 60 Marines, 27 were killed. And only a handful came back, not wounded. It was a disaster. And even worse for these Marines, they were not able to recover any of the bodies. They stayed out there. And so on March 30th, I think, 1968, they went back out there. Before dawn, they got in their assembly areas and were at the line of departure. They start moving. It's foggy. The NVA don't know they're there. As they move, they kind of move up in elevation a little bit, and so they come out of the fog, and then this fight starts, and they essentially catch the NVA by surprise, and then they get into a trench battle with, they were flamethrowers. I didn't know they used flamethrowers in Vietnam, but they did. And these guys are telling a story of clearing this trench line, and it's crazy. This guy, so it's all these different guys telling different pieces of the stories. This guy, it is, like I said, he's George Costanza. So I want you to listen to it. It's awesome. If you didn't listen to yesterday's Hour 3, it's one of the most intense things I've ever heard in my life. But it didn't play. Why didn't it play? Give me one second.
I'm not doing it.
Okay, that wasn't really a question for the, like, for the masses to go ahead and, give me a second. Don't anybody. What
the hell? Yeah, we're still here.
I'm.
Embrace technology.
I had to do some stuff on my computer yesterday. And. All right.
Wait. And they had dropped down. And so I plinked a couple of rounds, and I did.
Okay, so this is the dude that's in the trench line talking about it. Here you go.
Down. And we did that two or three times, and then I realized this was Pop Goes the Weasel. And that, so I quickly got up there out of rhythm, and when he came up, I just squeezed and shot. And it was the oddest thing. My instructor from the range in Camp Pendleton was there explaining to me about breathing and squeezing. My first shot, right in the head, right in the forehead. I had just done something I really didn't wish to do. And I'm laying there bewildered. And 20 feet away is another Pop Goes the Weasel. But he's shooting at my guys over here. And he's only 20 feet away and he keeps popping up and shooting. I didn't want to think too much about it because, for one thing, he's shooting live ammo at my people. So I just took aim and waited, and as he did it, I played the game again where I just squeezed and shot and hit him dead right through the temple, and he was gone.
They were still in.
And you think that marksmanship instructors aren't important in the Marine Corps? This guy's at caisson, clearing a trench, and he hears his marksmanship instructor in his head. Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Caisson, again, 50 years ago, the battle began, I want to say, in earnest on January 20th. And so pretty, pretty interesting little piece of audio. And as I said, the most intense, you can hear his, like, inner monologue going as he recounts that. What was the first time you ever got shot at?
Like, when the first time I ever shot at, when I saw someone shooting at me?
Yeah.
Would have been, let me see. It's a good question. It would have been my second deployment, because the assault in, well, I guess the assault in 2003 when I was in MLAV. No, that would have been it. It would have been in my 2003 assault when I was in MLAV when we rolled up on basically a company of Iraqi regulars dug in and woke up in the morning and they were looking at us. We were looking at them. It was like game on. They were shooting at us. But I didn't, you know, that wasn't fair because I was shooting a 25 millimeter at him inside the vehicle.
Okay, so first time you ever got shot at with a rifle?
Would have been my second deployment. Probably outside Ramadi. We got in, we were dismounted, we got into a firefight, and a guy came around the corner and he had an AK. He wasn't looking at me, but he had it leveled at his hip, and I just remember, you know, I just leveled my M4 at him, and I think I fired, you know, a quick succession of, you know, a couple rounds. And I knew I hit him because I saw him stagger, and then he ran around the corner. And then that was the first time, you know, that happened. And then it was just, and it was all over the time. It was, you know, here and there. I mean,
Well, especially that's when you were with Jerry Durant, right? So you guys ran into it everywhere.
Yeah, with Jerry. Yep. And then you know, and then it was times, it was just, you know, chance. It, you know, I never had anybody really kind of beat in on me. It was always like I saw them first.
Oh, really?
And so it was always easy. Yeah. But I never took headshots, man. I always shot in the body, you know.
Why not?
All right, because the head's small. It's hard to hit. Body's huge.
Yeah, in this case, the only thing he saw out of that trench line was the head, which, and again, that's in terms.
Yeah, I mean, if that's all I saw, I would have taken the shot.
Right.
The luckiest shot I ever did was I was running. I'll never forget this. Again, it was in Ramadi. I was running. We were taking fire. And I looked up and on the rooftop, a guy, I could just see like his shoulders and his head. And he was shooting over the building top. And as I was running, I just brought my rifle up and I was still in a run. And I brought it up and I squeezed. And I don't even know if I had a good sight picture. I was just, you know, brought it up to where I thought it was and I shot at him. And I think I just took a shot and I hit him right in the neck. And, man, he went down like, you know, a bag of shit. He went down fast. And I was, it was like, wow. You know, he kind of, like, man, I just can't believe I just did that.
That was crazy.
I could have never done that again.
Did you stop? Just like in the movies, right?
Yeah, that one was like, I could have never pulled that off again, ever.
You know, there's stuff like that happens.
I was moving quick.
I heard these guys from 2-4, they had taken a couple casualties on Route Michigan, which ran right through Ramadi. And so they're in a firefight, and it was their boxcar, and which is what their call sign for their logistics guys, that ran up and down the gauntlet of Route Michigan to resupply combat outposts in different places around the city. Anyway, so their company gunny is trying to coordinate suppression down a street just in order to pull a Marine or two across the street and medevac them. And so he grabs this PFC and he says, Musselman, come here. And, you know, Musselman's a PFC. And so he goes, hey, we're going to shoot, and you're going to run across the street, and you're going to tell them, I'm going to count. When I hit three, we'll shoot again, right? And we're gonna just lay down a ton of steel, and they're gonna drag those guys across the street. Got it? And so PFC Musselman, whoever he was, right? He yells, "Aye aye, Company Gunnery Sergeant!" Right in the middle of this firefight, right, Mike? And with that, all these heads turn and look like, "What the fuck did he just say?" And with that, the gunny grabs him and grabs him by the shirt and says, "Don't you ever say that shit to me again. You got it." He's like, "Yes, got it." And so he shoves them. But they're describing this, and he said, if you could imagine in the midst of all this, like, this symphony of death that's going on, this PFC
right.
yells, "Aye, aye, Company Gunnery Sergeant," and he said people are laughing, you know, in the midst of all this stuff. So, anyway, funny, in the midst of funny stuff. So you can.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of comedy that goes on in a gunfight.
Oh, my God. One of Mike's funnier stories is he tells a story about going out and to confiscate weapons at a near combat outpost in on the other side of Ramadi and coming back and getting into being ambushed, essentially, and fighting and 50 cals going off and all kinds of crazy.
Oh, yeah, Mark 19 and everything.
And then in the middle of it, Colonel Durant getting out of the vehicle with his 45. Wait, what's going on out here? Like, I'm not exactly sure, man, but the
9 millimeter.
Yeah, 9 mil. But the metal density in the air might be a little bit too thick out there, Colonel. You might want to hop back in here. Anyway.
Well, you know, and I had another colonel after that, and we were doing something one time, and he wanted to go in a bad place of town, and I told him, I said, that's not a good idea. And, you know, it was his first time in combat, this guy. And, he wanted to go, you know, whip it on with the bad guys. And I said, that's a bad idea. Let's go a different route. I know another way to get there where we're not going to go through, you know, basically, you know, Boyle Heights to get there. So let's do this. And he goes, what are you, afraid, Gunner? And I said, no, I'm not afraid. And I said, if you want to play who's got bigger balls, I'll walk out there with you, just you and me. Let's go. Let's just walk. And, I'm game. I don't care. I mean, I like getting shot at. It's fun. But, I don't want to put these guys at risk. You know, our PSD, our group of guys, you know, our five vehicles, every time we went out, we were handing out a medal or a Purple Heart. So, I mean, these guys were taking the licks. And, I mean, I had a guy, in that tour, in one tour, he received three Purple Hearts. And finally, on his third one, we sent him home. Like, okay, no more. You know, so, there's a time to be smart and, you know, and pick your fights. But, if you just go out to look for trouble, you know, that's just,
samurai.
That's fine if you want to do that by yourself.
It's a samurai violation because you don't have any right to risk the lives of other Marines and the whole notion of battlefield tourism. You know?
Yeah, that just drove me crazy.
It's bullshit. And you get guys who don't get, you know, look, everybody wants to be a lieutenant, a lance corporal, a sergeant, right? A corporal and get out there and whoop it on. But guess what? That's not everybody's job. And if you want to go out and play that game, and guess who's doing your job? Oh, nobody is today.
No one, and no one volunteers to be the guy they mortalize and your right. body come home in a flag draped casket.
Right.
No one signs up to be that guy.
Right.
But that's what normally happens when you get guys that want to be here, you know.
Right.
Heroes
right.
and Rambos and,
right.
and
don't
someone's going to have to play that role.
Yeah. And I mean, Mike and I both have experiences in our deployment to 2006 where somebody disobeyed a direct order and guys got killed. And it's tough, you know, and people have to live with that kind
oh, yeah.
of shit. And,
yeah. And I was just talking to, you know, I opened up about that a little bit with somebody the other day and, you know, about that incident and, you know, when we got hit really bad that day and we recovered one of our mortally wounded guys, and we were racing back to Tecatum, and, you know, and he was from Texas, and he was a great guy, you know, Cheeks Ramirez, Benito Cheeks Ramirez, and always smiling, always got something funny to say, just a smart alecky Mexican kid, and just a fun, full-of-life kid, and he was our gunner, and he paid with his life that day, and I'll never forget it, man. I mean, that was the first time, Mac, that I actually had my hand on a human heart trying to keep it beating. And, that's something that, you know, you get a guy who's got his midsection blown out and he's got two holes on each side of his chest and he's losing blood and you're trying to do everything you can to stop him. And you got, you know, five guys in the back of a Humvee where it only seats two and the corpsman is there on top of him trying to resuscitate him and you're trying to stop, you know, the bleeding from whatever you can. You're just reaching in and grabbing things to stop and, you know, blood from coming out of him. And it was a horrible day. And, I was pissed. I mean, I was beside myself that this did not have to happen that day.
There was an optional event. Optional event, and then, and you know what's interesting, Mike, about this watching this Case On documentary. This stuff was recorded maybe 2 or 3 years ago, so 47 years after the fact, that guy is living it like it was yesterday. And I think, you know what I mean? And I think what's important for guys, young guys to know, and the reason why I would say watch these things is they're illustrative in that what you do, one, as Maximus says, will echo in eternity. Okay. And you will live with it. You aren't getting over it because listen to these guys. They can describe this thing like they lived it this morning, which is, you know, 40, almost 50 years later. And so, serious business for serious people. And that's why, I mean, you know, Mike and I, you know, again, talking about certain issues, this comes up, and both of us, I wasn't there that day. I only saw the aftermath. And I was pissed.
Last night, I relived an episode that happened 14 years ago. I went to bed. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and I closed my eyes, and I'm trying to go to sleep. And as my eyes were closed, I could see flashlight, or I could see, like, light flickering. And then I still heard voices. So I'm popping up, and I'm looking around. And every time I closed my eyes, what had happened was it took me back to a place where, when we were in Ramadi working with the Iraqis, there were times that we had to spend time with the Iraqis, or we were in Iraqi areas, and it was not a lot of Marines with us, and so we're sleeping in among Iraqi soldiers or police guys, you know, outside of the wire, you know, in basically their camps, or we're out in the middle of nowhere, and the only time I could sleep in those situations is when I had a gun underneath my head, so I'd always have my sidearm, you know, loaded, and then be sleeping with it. And then so, like, at the JCC or the police station or, you know, so you're out in the middle of town and, you know, there's not a lot of Marines there. Help is, you know, 35, 45 minutes away. And there's, like, 100 Iraqis. You don't know these guys. And you're trying to sleep through the night. That's a difficult thing to do. And,
well, the answer is,
so, like, the other night.
You don't do it very much, right? You sleep.
No. And so, like, last night I kept going back there.
Every noise.
And, yeah, or not last night, the night before, I couldn't sleep. So I woke up, and my wife woke up, and she looked at me, and unbeknownst to me, I had my freaking Glock under my pillow in my house. And she looked at me, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Why do you have a pistol?" And I look, I'm like, holy shit. You know, my finger was straight, not the trigger.
Yeah, boy.
And, but it was the only thing I could do to get myself to relax. So, like, last night, I slept, and I felt good. I just woke up, I mean, shit, about an hour ago.
Nice.
But, yeah, those are the, and that was 14 years ago. I mean, these guys are still, and it's never going to go away,
right.
You know. And these guys deal with it all the time. Or, you know, you deal with things, and it's a horrible thing. You know, and that's why I never wish combat for anybody. Right. You know, and you look back at all young Marines, they want experience, or a service member, it's like a rite of passage or something. But, you know, once you do it, you kind of regret it. And I can understand why this guy never wanted to shoot anybody, because you don't want to live with that.
You know, and then all the different permutations of that. There's one guy in it that the day that patrol went out, when so many guys got killed, his brother was in Vietnam. And he got on a helicopter the day before and went down to see his brother. And then came back the following day, and his entire squad is dead. And he said,
"Yeah,
I've carried this burden for all this time, and I've thought about this interview for months, what I would say. I've been trying to prove myself ever since by doing crazy things because of the guilt I feel that I wasn't there to help that day." And he dissolves. And so you see all the different shades of that experience. And how it weighs on people. And that's why I think watching these things is good, especially for young Marines and young soldiers and sailors and airmen, because it prepares you for joining that fraternity in which the experiences and the reason you need to have your ass and your brain wired together is because it's serious shit and you cannot take it back. And so, the two Navy commanding officers of those ships, they will live the rest of their lives knowing that whether, no matter what they get convicted of, that their negligence caused the death and caused incredible pain to 17 different families across the nation. And there's nobody that can take that, alleviate that from them. That's why you train hard. That's why you do have your shit together. That's why you surround yourself with good people and all that kind of stuff. So it's just. It's an awesome fraternity to be a part of. It's one that comes with certainly its downside, but none of it goes away. And so, no, Mike, I think about that, and it just still makes me sick to my stomach that was an optional event and did not have to happen. The first time I ever you know, got my hands on somebody that was dying. And the worst part is, for people that never had the experience, you're trying as hard as you can to help them live. Your hands are on them, right? In my case, I can remember I can remember seeing his jugular vein literally pulsing out of his neck because his body knew that it was in trouble, and he was dying. But he's doing, you know, he was paralyzed. And I was doing everything. A Huey crashed 50 meters in front of my LAV, pilot decapitated, co-pilot crushed to death, and you're trying to save a sergeant and a corporal, and it's not working. And this intimate, hands-on dance with death, you never, you can't get over it, and you learn to live with it.
Yeah, and when you're looking at somebody and you're holding their hand and you know that they're taking their last breaths, and then it's powerful, and it lives with you, and you know you're trying to comfort them, and hell, you'll tell them every lie in the book just to make them feel better
before they die.
And and it's just, you know, just to know that, you know, like you said, some of these guys, you know, I guess the saving grace is they died in the company of their family, their brothers, you know, people that cared about them, people that wanted to give their own life for them.
Right.
And they weren't alone. And those are kind of the messages that you get across. And those are tough things, you know, that you got to battle with. And, you know, every once in a while you're reminded of those guys. And it's just, like you said, nothing good comes from it, you know, from these things that we do.
But you know, in fact, it's interesting that both of our experience are similar in that mine happened because a Huey helicopter pilot decided to fly 7 feet off the ground up Wood Canyon, brushed the side of the canyon, and but for the grace of God, didn't kill more Marines on the ground. In no way, shape, or form is he supposed to be doing that. Right? In Mike's case, the route was black. I mean, we hadn't swept it. And we knew that there were these Iranian, you know, these Iranian penetrators were absolutely positively lethal, and we knew they were in the area. Yet somebody decided to do it anyway. And that's, so not only do you deal with the experience, which sucks, but then you deal with it didn't have to happen. It didn't have to happen. Yeah. That beautiful young person.
And that was everywhere. I mean,
right.
Afghanistan, you know, we had lost guys going into compounds that they should have been sweeping the doorway frame. We lost guys that they were going on a short patrol from one fire base to another, you know, and they could see it. They could see the lights of it, but they decided not to use the metal detectors or, you know, just people doing stupid things.
Right.
They allowed it for, you know, they just let their guard down. And as leaders, you can't do that.
I got this, right? I got this. And you know what? And Mike and I talk about it all the time. In fact, it's a common theme on the program. It's the discipline that keeps you from doing those things. Do it right. Do it by the numbers. And there's a reason. There's a reason that you do it that way. And I go on. And Mike and I worked on in Afghanistan. We worked a lot of this stuff together. And that is, you know, the last 31 guys that were killed. In RCT1, 19 of them our lack of discipline was a contributing factor, and they had all kinds of different reasons for doing the things that they did, but our lack of discipline was a contributing factor, and then you have to live with it, and it sucks. But anyway,
all right, man.
What else are you gonna do today? Anything exciting?
Today, no, I'm gonna take it easy, man. We were gonna have I was going to be at the Republican Executive Committee tonight. I'm just going to walk away from that. I'm going to the wife for dinner because I haven't been home all night. Every night I've been gone with this election stuff. So I've only seen the wife like for 10 minutes total. So so we're going to go to dinner tonight. We're going to spend some time together.
Attaboy. All right, man. Have a good one.
All right, Mac. I'll talk to you later.
All right. There you have it. The one and only Michael Musselman here. Battle Buddies are awesome. From Montana Man, he just wrote, this is not the hole I want to be in. Awesome segment. Yeah, like I said, if you haven't listened to yesterday's third hour, listen to it. It is the most vivid oral history I've ever heard in my life. And then you heard a little bit more of it today. So, with the Gunner. Again, I'm in my life, I'm blessed. If you could meet these characters you kind of sort of hear, you'd discover what great dudes they are. And, you know, the guys that I served with in Afghanistan, that group, was absolutely positively off the hook. Awesome. And, but you know, in every deployment you have, you know, my first deployment, right? John Kelly, Dunford, Mattis, guys like Clark Lethine, Craig Tucker, John Toulin, Sparky Renforth, Paul Kennedy, Dave Furness, all, you know, general officers or colonels, did great stuff. And so, it's an incredible privilege to serve with those guys, but it's a heavy burden. And reminded of again by those Marines at Quezon, I would tell all of us would tell you we didn't do that. We didn't use flamethrowers and clear trenches and things like that. Yeah, that's big ball stuff. The Auburn Radiohead chef will join us tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit of cooking, and we'll talk about something else too. Have a great day. This program repeats itself right now on a Thursday. All Marine Radio, almost over. My thanks to Justice Ulowitz from Navy Times. Covered the Marine Corps for Stars and Stripes in Iraq. So he'd been to Iraq multiple times, as well as Afghanistan. Transitioned to the United States Navy, and now covers the Navy for Navy Times. So you can find him, Jeff, G-E-O-F-F, Zulowitz. Yeah, starts with a Z. You'll find it. A lot of consonants in it. So check his work out. He does good shit. My thanks to him for coming on. So hopefully the first of a few times that he'll come on and discuss issues. And again, I will say, I'll end today with this. Don't be distracted by this bullshit about sleep and can't say no before going to sea. When you sit down, and I need to get Montana Man on. Maybe I'll get Montana Man on tomorrow to talk about. He's the regimental XO. He doesn't need pretty much a battalion commander to tell him what he can and can't do, because he already knows. He sits in those small group readiness meetings. He knows where they are in training. He knows what they're capable of. So this whole thing that, well, we were assigned a mission and we couldn't do it, and I couldn't push back. Then, I mean, the guy above in the 7th Fleet, I think a Desron commander, the destroyer squadron commander, that guy's already been relieved. His career's already over. But maybe that was a problem. Maybe he was the idiot in all of that. And his job is to put those guys in a position to accomplish the task that they've been assigned. Missions. Okay? That's his job. As their CO, he's not going to sea. So what is his job? To make sure that everything that gets them to sea is covered. Yes? Yes. So, don't buy the sleep. I mean, basic seamanship, basic navigation, all that. Navy's got to be able to do that. And all the rest of this bullshit, not being able to say no, only weak leaders and weak commanders do that. So, with that editorial, on a Thursday, All Marine Radio, over and out. This program repeats itself, right? Hold it. No.